Sure is good to see all of y'all this morning. I'm not sure how many of you were woken this morning by the glory of God at about 2:30 as the thunderstorms rumbled through. And I lay there listening to that and I thought to myself, our God is majestic. And He does some incredible things at incredible times. And I found the channel changer. Praise God for that. We're going to take a break this morning from the book of Philippians. I've been following that through over the last, couple of months now. But this morning I wanted to pause and look at the death and the resurrection of Christ. And just by way of reminder, like Peter reminds us, you know, I write these things to you, not because you have need for new information, but I write these things to you as a reminder of that which you already know, so that your faith may be strengthened. And so that's what I hope to do this morning as we look at the death and the burial of Christ. Somewhat of a bleak situation to be, or circumstance to be looking at, but the outcome is so glorious that it warrants our meditation on a constant basis. As we look at the reality and the facts relating to Christ and His life, we understand beyond any shadow of doubt that Jesus was not the first, nor was He the last, to die unjustly. There's many people who have died unjustly in the world that we live in, and even in the world that we live in today, there are people who die needlessly and unjustly. But that is not the reason why He demands and deserves our worship. That's not the reason why we assemble on a weekly basis, why people, millions of people around the world, on the first day of the week assemble to worship and to glorify and to honor God. I found a quote, and I wish I knew who wrote it, and I would give him credit for it, but it's an unknown quote, and I think it's one of the most profound quotes that I know of and that I've heard of in my lifetime. And the quote is simply this: the best news the world has ever had came from a graveyard near Jerusalem. And I think that's really profound. When we think about that, when we contemplate on the extent of meaning in that one comment, is absolutely profound. And so the biggest question that plagues man even today in the world that we live in is a simple question that asks, what happened to the body of Jesus? So much has been written about the Christ. So much has been recorded in history by people well known like Josephus and others who have written about the things pertaining to Him. And even as archaeology unfolds new evidences from the past, there is so much that is written about Him. And yet, where is the body? What happened to the body? How did they dispose of the body of this man who was so publicly well known? Where did it go? What happened to it? Why didn't the Jews, who were so opposed to Jesus, why didn't they produce the corpse and stop Christianity before it even started? Why didn't they just present the body and say, well, here it is, all of the stuff that Jesus spoke is a bunch of hooey. And it would have stopped right there and then. When the disciples started preaching, why didn't they produce the corpse and make fools of them in the very city where Jesus died and was crucified? And so the question really is a question that goes begging, and a question that needs to be visited and revisited more often than not. And the question is really, what happened to the body of Jesus? And so I'd like to suggest to you, there are several things that we can consider as we look at that. I don't know what happened there. Thank you. the first thing that I want to share with you this morning as we look at that is the body of Jesus was stolen by his disciples. Now that's what people said back then, and that's what the arguments were. And so they came up and they said, oh, his disciples stole the body, and that's why we cannot produce it. But when we look at the gospel accounts, in the gospel of Matthew, Matthew accuses the high priest of bribing the people to circulate this false rumor. You know, they didn't have Google, or they didn't have Twitter, or they didn't have social media back then, but they had a grapevine that was just as effective as the social media of the world that we live in today. And so they circulated this gossip, these tall stories, these untruths that people readily believed before they would even consider the truth. And they said that, well, they stole his body. But think about it for a moment. If you're a rational person and you look at the text and you read the gospel accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus, you understand that the guards who were posted at the tomb of Jesus weren't people who were just picked out of a lineup of people who just arbitrarily decided they were going to serve in the Praetorian Guard. But these were well-decorated soldiers who understood and knew beyond any shadow of doubt their responsibilities when they were given a task. In fact, their responsibilities, if they fell foul of them, were punishable by death. And so these guards didn't just fall asleep while they were on guard duty. They didn't just turn a blind eye to what was happening. They didn't just pause and not hear all of the noise that it would have taken to dismantle everything on that tomb door or that tombstone and just roll it away from there. And so that creates an incredible problem to the validity of this charge, your suggestion. Compounding that, there was the other basic problem that we need to consider as well. Why do what we would call illiterate fishermen, men who stood by their honor, men who knew what it was to roll up their sleeves and put in an honest day's work, men whose word was their bond, why would they lie for someone who had died and they knew he was still dead? See, it just doesn't make sense. It makes absolutely no sense at all. And then we look at the second question that comes out of the same thing. And Julia, you may have to advance the slides for me because this isn't working. My fingers maybe are not working. And the second one is the body was stolen by the enemies of Jesus Christ. You see, the Jews didn't want Jesus' disciples to steal the body. So the suggestion is that they went ahead and stole the body before the disciples had an opportunity to take it. But the same questions come up with that silly comment. And the question is simply, well, where was the corpse? If they stole the body because they wanted to prove that Jesus didn't raise from the dead, why didn't they just produce the corpse? Why is there absolutely no evidence of anybody showing up with the corpse at all? And then when you consider that the preaching of the disciples started in the very city that Jesus was crucified, surely there would have been somebody who had some evidence that they would have come forward and said, well, here's the body, or it's over there, or somebody took it over there, and they would have found some sort of paper trail or blood trail that would have led them to discover where the body was. And so it would have been easy to prove. And then the third comment that comes out from this is that there is what they call the swoon theory. That after Jesus had been through all of the brutality that he had experienced on the cross, the flogging beforehand, the ripping of his back to hamburger, the loss of blood, the fact that he hadn't slept or eaten or drank for a long period of time, that he was so totally totally exhausted that when he was on the cross, he really didn't die. He just kind of swooned. He passed out, as it were. And that when they laid him in the tomb, the coolness and the serenity of the tomb somehow miraculously revived him. To the point where he had enough strength to single-handedly open up the stone that was rolled and sealed in front of the tomb. And so you've got to be a believer in Hollywood to believe that to be real. If you believe the social media, you would believe that swoon theory as well. And so we need to recognize the reality of what has been said. And so these arguments, as it is, that have been put up by history, by people of the past, that try to identify and indicate what happened to the body of Jesus, really do not hold any water at all. They have no validity at all. Nothing that can be proved in any way that would consider them to be good arguments. And so, when we look past that, and we go into what we call the book of Acts, and we read through the book of Acts, it really is an account of the preaching about the resurrected Christ. And so if you back off, and if you're a daily Bible reader, and you've read through the Bible, or if you've heard people talk about the Bible, and talk about the book of Acts really is an account of what happened in the early church and the validity of the preaching about Christ and the role of God and the role that God had for Jesus in establishing his church. The interesting thing for me as I read through the book of Acts is that the disciples never tried to prove that Jesus died. And when you read through it, it's interesting that that argument is never really presented. But what they did is they just preached it like it was the truth. As if to say, well, you know, why do I need to try to substantiate this? Because it's true anyway. And so throughout the book of Acts, their preaching is very positive about the Christ, not trying to prove or disprove anything. And the most powerful point of the book of Acts, I think, is not just the preaching of the disciples, but it's the silence of the critics. And as we read through the book of Acts, we hear, and it is recorded, some of the criticism that comes from the critics, especially from the scribes and the Pharisees. And yet, never once is there any indication as to what happened to the body of Jesus, and that somebody had taken this body away. In the city that he was killed, there is absolutely nothing that I'm aware of, and I've done some pretty extensive research in trying to uncover some of the stories and some of the things relating to the death of Jesus, but there is absolutely nothing recorded by anyone who can deny the death of Jesus or who can deny the resurrection of the Christ. And so the same question plagues us and stands in front of us. And that is, what happened to the body of Jesus? Where is it? I think there's some valid considerations that we can briefly look at this morning. We really don't have time to exhaust any of them any more than we did some of the comments that are made about the criticisms about his resurrection. But the first is the fact that there is a certainty of death. I think before we even look at Christianity in any way at all, we need to recognize and we need to consider the certainty of the death of Jesus. Because if he did not die, if we cannot establish the fact that he died, then everything else that we believe in and everything else that we teach and preach is disputable and can be considered to be erroneous. And so my question, as we look at that, stems from a very simple question that relates back to the Romans. Why were they convinced of the death of Jesus Christ? We go back into the Gospel of Matthew, and in Matthew chapter 27, towards the end there, in verse 54, the Roman centurions who were at the death of Christ at the foot of the cross, they even are recorded as saying, surely this man is the Son of God. The Romans knew the business of execution. They had learned from the Assyrians, and they were masters at punishing people and don't you love it when you lose your words? They were masters of giving excruciating pain and punishment to people in the process of death. They knew how to kill people. They knew how to stretch it out. They knew how to prolong the death. And they knew beyond any shadow of doubt when somebody finally, physically, gave up and died. They knew that. They were experts at their craft. And so, when we look at the text, and we look at the scriptures, we understand that they, beyond any shadow of doubt, knew that Jesus had died. John chapter 12, and I think down there in about verse 30, 31, maybe 32, speaks about the fact, and that when Jesus gave up his life, from the very time that he gave up his life, people would begin to lift him up and honor him and glorify him. And it was a prophecy about himself. And at this very hour, that prophecy started to be fulfilled. At the very time that he died, and it started with the Romans themselves, who acknowledged that this man surely must have been God. Joseph of Arimathea, the man that was spoken of in the text that David read for us, a man who was well sought after, a man who was a high businessman, came out of the darkness and offered his tomb for Jesus. Now you understand that he would have risked all sorts of reprisals because that he came out in support of Christ. Not only Joseph of Arimathea did the text speak of, but it also spoke of Nicodemus, who we had read about earlier on in the Gospel of John in chapter 3, who came and spoke directly with Jesus under the cover of dark because he was fearful that he would have been taken advantage of by his fellow senators and people who served in the council of the Jerusalem people. And so these men would not have risked themselves in any fashion at all, being businessmen and men who were held in high esteem within the community, were they not convinced that Jesus had died. And yet both of them very openly exposed themselves in daylight in support of the Christ. These people would not have buried him if he wasn't dead. They wouldn't have buried a cadaver or some of somebody else's body. And so we look at the text and we understand that. And on Sunday, the first day of the week, which is why we assemble to worship God on the first day of the week, which is why really we celebrate what we call the communion feast every Sunday in remembrance not only of his death, but more importantly, of his resurrection. And so Sunday, the first day of the week, the third day after his crucifixion, which is important for us to remember, that Mary and some of the other ladies had come to finish the embalming process. And early in the morning they got up on Sunday, that first day, and made their way to the tomb where it was. And you can imagine them walking towards the tomb as the dawn was breaking, the birds began chirping, and the warmness came through the grain of the morning as they approached the tomb. And when they arrived there, they found that the tomb was open. Turn in your Bibles, if you are or not already not there, to John chapter 20. Now I want you to notice something here in the text, starting with verse 2. Because the text here gives us some remarkable insights as to what happened on that eventful day. And so she ran, and this is Mary and Martha, they ran back to where Peter and John and the other disciples were to tell them, somebody's taken the body of Jesus. It's not there. Verse 2. So she ran and she came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb and we do not know where they have laid him. And Peter therefore went forth with the other disciple. And they were going to the tomb. And get the picture now. They were anxious. The text tells us that they were running together. And the other disciple ran faster than Peter. Tells you something about Peter, doesn't it? Maybe he's just slow. Could have been. And John came to the tomb first. I want you to notice verse 5. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings laying there, but he didn't go in. Now, unfortunately, the English language isn't really as graphic as the Greek is sometimes. And I almost hate using Greek when I'm speaking publicly. But here it's an important thing for us to understand, because the word that is used where he saw is a word that is used that he looked in and he just casually observed. Kind of like what you would do if you came into this auditorium and you looked in and you saw, oh wow, there's a lot of people here. And that's what he saw. Verse 6. Then Simon Peter therefore also came in, and I imagine he was huffing and puffing behind him, and following him he entered the tomb. He kind of ran on and he went into the tomb. And he beheld the linen wrappings lying there. And the word for beheld is a word that is he saw and he observed some of the critical things that were in there. And so maybe if you came into this auditorium and you came in and you observed that everybody was sitting down and nobody was sitting in the front pews on either side of the building. And it would be seeing some things with some knowledge or some observation that really there's some things that I remember here. And so that's the word that is used. And then verse 7, the text carries on. And it says, and the face cloth which he had been on his head, not lined with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. And so text goes on to record that which John had seen. So it wasn't just merely a casual observation that he saw, but he saw some things that convinced him that something significant had happened here. So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb, he now entered. And then also, it says, and he saw and believed. And the word that is used here is the word that we get our expression, aha, now I see, from. The light bulb came on. And he came in and he observed all of these things and suddenly it made sense to him. And he had a comprehension of what has happened. And he took in the whole picture. Maybe he had gotten his breath by now. Maybe he had seen the expressions and the reaction of John before him. But he came in and he saw, and what he saw convinced him beyond any shadow of doubt. And he absolutely comprehended what was in front of him and what was happening. Now the point of all of that is precisely this, beloved. There's enough evidences, factual recorded evidences, not only in the scriptures, and that should be sufficient, but extra material in Josephus, in Tacitus, and in some of the papyri, and some of the early church fathers, in the writings that we have available to us. There was enough evidence that to believe that Jesus indeed is alive, and he wasn't confined to the tomb. And I think that's important that we understand that. And especially on days like today, where we can be reminded of these things. It's important that we understand that. And so why is it important that we understand these things? Two reasons that I'd like to suggest to you this morning for your consideration as we leave from here. And the first is this. For us to live without faith in the resurrection is to ignore the evidences. Is to believe a lie, is to believe the social media, is to believe the gossip and the garbage that floats around in the world. To live without faith in the resurrection is to ignore the intrinsic evidences that point to the authenticity of the death and the resurrection of Christ. We desperately, and I emphasize that, we desperately need to understand that Jesus Christ is real. And He is alive today. And it's a fact. It's not some figment of the imagination. It's not just some nice religious belief that we pull out of the corner of our lives every now and then when we need Him or we need some encouragement. But Jesus Christ is real. The stone was rolled away not to let Jesus out, but the stone was rolled away for us to see in that He was no longer contained in the tomb. That's why it was rolled away. And the problem is not that there is a lack of evidence, but the problem is because people choose not to believe. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and right towards the end there in verse 58, it speaks about the fact that people choose not to believe, and it's their choice. And so my question, beloved, this morning is simply this. If you do believe, then why do you not do the things that God says for us to do? And that's a challenging thought, isn't it? And so the whole concept of Easter, of what we celebrate on this day, is called into question with that one simple question. And the second thing for us to consider is to die without faith. And we spoke about the certainty of death. And I'm not trying to be morbid, and I'm not trying to be insensitive in any way at all, but that all of us are appointed to die one time. One day. And to die without faith in the resurrection is to ignore the reality of eternity. We were created to live eternally. And we will do that either with God or without God. In the presence of God or not in the presence of God. And there's a great scripture in the Old Testament in the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 3 and down there in verse 11. In fact, the whole of chapter 3 speaks about a time for this and a time for that. And it talks about a time to die and a time to live, a time to celebrate and a time to mourn. And it speaks about the fact that there is a time for us to seriously consider our eternity. There's a part of us, all of us, who really wants to live eternally in a good place. The thought of living eternally separated from God in a dark place where there's just torment and exposure to all sorts of garbage doesn't appeal to us. That's how God has made us. He's created us with this capacity to yearn after Him. And to live with Him. Jesus conquered the grave for us. So that we can have a hope. Not a hope that is wishy-washy, well, I hope this is going to happen. But a hope based upon reasonable facts of evidence. He died on the cross for sin. And He left the grave for life. And a way for His disciples to follow. That's what's significant about the first day of the week. That's what's significant about the resurrected Christ. And really, that's the story of the gospel. The death, the burial, and the resurrection of Christ. He is risen, beloved. I believe that with all my heart. And I would hope and believe that you do too. Because nothing makes sense in this world, and especially in the world that we live in today, without God. Our hope is in His resurrection. Our hope is in the fact that He already has claimed the victory on our behalf. We know what the end result is already. And so we need to live our lives with a perspective that recognizes that the victory is already ours. And the deciding point is when we understand and accept the fact that the body of Jesus is no longer in the grave. But He's risen. And He's alive. And He is the Messiah. And He is the only means by which we come to the Father. And so this morning, if you contemplate those things, and there's things that are in your life that maybe you need to rectify, maybe this morning is a good time to start that, or to make that choice of decision. We have some of our elders here this morning. I know that they would be delighted to pray with you and talk with you this morning if you have a need. And so, as we stand and as we sing, if you have a need to respond, won't you do it?